Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Gaffney, the program that's a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic, to the glory of God and his kingdom. Speaking of the glory of God and his kingdom, I am privileged to have as a personal friend and a hugely admired colleague, a woman who has devoted her entire professional life to advancing the cause of the Lord and the kingdom, notably, but not exclusively, during her distinguished time in the United States Congress, representing the people of Minnesota, among other things, serving on the House Intelligence Committee. She went on to run for president. She has been in the public spotlight in a lot of other capacities, notably in her present role as the Dean of the Robertson School of Government at Regent University. Her name, of course, is Michelle Bachmann. The former congresswoman is, among other things, one of our leading lights in the Sovereignty Coalition. She has been doing unbelievably important work educating people about the threat to our sovereignty posed by what the Biden administration is doing with a number of others to, well, I'd like to say, crush our sovereignty. And we're here with her to talk about that and what you can do about it. Congresswoman Bachmann, welcome back to Securing America. It's so good to have you with us.
Frank, it's always a pleasure to be with you.
I want to thank you, really, from the bottom of my heart for what you've done over so many years and so many different roles to stand up for the freedom of the American people and the Constitution that you swore an oath, as I did, to support and defend. And as you know, there's no statute of limitations or time limit on that oath. You live it every single day. And I want you to just set the stage for this conversation, if you would, by talking a little bit about how you came to be aware of and become so deeply engaged in this issue of the World Health Organization.
Well, it was really by accident. It was last year, about this time, when I first learned that the Biden administration was flying very low under the radar in a non-transparent way. And they had an effort that shocked me to the core of my soul. And their effort was actually to pass amendments at the World Health Assembly in Geneva, Switzerland, for the purpose of changing the World Health Organization from an international advisory only health board to an agency that would have international authority analogous to our own CDC. And CDC in the United States, the Centers for Disease Control, actually is also only an advisory board, but President Joe Biden treated the CDC and Dr. Fauci as though whatever they stated was law, as though they were a legislature. And we were operating under emergency powers. For many Americans don't realize, these extraordinary lawless actions that were taken by the Biden administration were done under the auspices of emergency powers. We've only just this week come out from under emergency powers for the first time in 3 years. What's audacious and what I saw last year and this year is that the Biden administration wanted to take this extraordinary authority to declare emergency powers, so essentially any action could be taken that the leader wanted to take. That level of power was about to be given to the United Nations healthcare arm, the World Health Organization. Now, decisions like masking, lockdowns, mandatory vaccines, other decisions that would attack America's sovereignty would be given to the World Health Organization. But the Biden administration didn't want to stop there. They wanted all 194 member nations, that's virtually every human being on earth, to come under the control of the dictates of the leader of the World Health Organization. That is sovereignty. This is a sovereignty issue. And what does that big word mean, sovereignty? It means that we have independent authority as a nation. We're an independent nation. We call our own shots here. But President Biden, in what I consider a treasonous action, wants to give away our power to govern ourselves to the United Nations, creating for the first time in all of human history an international platform for global governance. This is absolutely outrageous. It's unthinkable. It cannot happen because, as you know, Frank, if this happens, the United States will essentially give away who we are as a country, a free people. And instead, we will become captives and somewhat slaves to the World Health Organization.
I want you to talk about, excuse me, Michelle Bachmann, I want you to talk about a particularly insidious instrument for doing all of the things that you just talked about. And that is this, plan for the World Health Organization to issue or have otherwise implemented digital medical cards, identity cards, vaccine passports, whatever you want to call them, that would be universally required and that can become a platform for something very, very dangerous indeed. Talk us through all of that and why that's a particular concern.
Well, Frank, you've done an excellent job trying to alert people to the perils of communist China and how communist China controls their own people and disenfranchises their own people. Essentially, that same type of system is what is being envisioned by the World Health Organization to control every man, woman, and child on earth. And it would be quite simply, if you look at your iPhone, the goal is to put a QR code, a separate digital identity for every human on earth. That digital identity would show up on your iPhone, and whoever has that QR code would be subject to whatever demands the World Health Organization puts upon them, whether it's demands for vaccines, boosters, testing, whatever it is that they require. What we see from the future is that the World Health Organization envisions that our medical records would be contained in that QR code, again, with access to the international body known as the World Health Organization. So we would lose privacy over our health records. But worse, they're envisioning combining that together with digital banking, with the ability to buy and sell, and unthinkably, even the ability to travel. Many of your viewers right now have experienced that when they've gone. For instance, I've gone on Delta Airlines. I've traveled to Israel. And when I come up to the gate to load on the plane, I don't even have to show my ticket. They just take a photo of my face. And based upon that, I enter on the plane. That is surveillance. And so on our phone, we would be tracked, traced, surveilled for the purpose of being controlled. We couldn't move unless we satisfy the requirements by an international authority. This has never happened before, and this is something that we're extremely concerned about.
You're very kind about talking about the work we've been doing with the Committee on the Present Danger of China, and you too have been on this case about China. The reason this is such an important, and relevant point is we don't have to imagine
that's right
how this digital database and identity cards and so on can be weaponized against free people. We can see it in practice in the Chinese Communist Party's so-called social credit system. And Michelle, just a quick word, and we have to take a short break, but is there any doubt in your mind that once this kind of infrastructure is in place with the World Health Organization, that's where this
goes? Oh, there's no doubt at all. We know for a fact that this is the system that is being built right now. There's numerous news stories about it. And just recognize, for the last 3 years, we've already been living under the dictates of the World Health Organization. So we have a preview.
Hold that thought. No, we're going to come back to that because that is such an incredibly important point. Michelle Bachmann is in the house. I'm pleased to say we've got another segment with her coming right up. Don't move. We'll be right back. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. What can I do? You probably have asked that question maybe daily, as our country is being taken down by Biden administration officials hostile to this republic and routinely breaching their oaths of office to support and defend its constitution. Well, here's something consequential that every American can do today. If you don't want Team Biden to surrender our national sovereignty and your personal sovereignty to a totalitarian world government it is stealthily establishing, join us for the Wexit National Day of Action. Go to sovereigntycoalition.org and tell your elected representatives you want us to exit the World Health Organization now. Every congressional office in America should hear from at least one of their constituents, ideally, on this Wexit Day. Put your legislators on notice. They must ensure our public health policy will be determined by the USA, not the WHO. This is Frank Gaffney. Welcome back. Talking with former Congresswoman Michelle Bachmann about the insidious threat to your freedom, to your personal sovereignty and that of our nation. And we've just been visiting about a piece of the threat that is now emerging from the World Health Organization and the Biden administration's connivance to empower it beyond imagining, with respect in particular to the prospects of it turning into a digital gulag for the entire world. And to help make this case, Michelle Bachmann has pointed us to the following one-minute clip, and we're just going to turn to it now, and we'll be right back with Michelle.
So let's have a digital health certificate acknowledged by WHO if you have been vaccinated or tested properly, then you can move around. So for the next pandemic, instead of stopping the movement of the people 100%, which clogged the economy globally, you know, you can still provide some movement of the people. Indonesia has achieved, G20 country has agreed to have this digital certificate using WHO standard, and we will submit into the next World Health Assembly in Geneva as the revision to international health regulation. So hopefully for the next pandemic, we can still see some movement of the people, some movement of the goods, and movement of the economy.
Michelle Bachmann, brief us on what that was about and who the speaker is.
Well, last November of 2022, in the first week, the B20 met, the G20 met. The clip that you saw was from the B20, the 20 largest corporations. They were meeting in Bali. And what the foreign minister of Indonesia was saying is that we are planning, all of us in the G20 and the B20, we're planning on this digital certificate. We're planning to offer amendments at the World Health Assembly to change the rules to require and mandate that every person on Earth has a digital identity and a digital QR code. And it's really telling. He said that, you know, during the last pandemic, everyone had to stay home. And he's saying, well, not everyone will have to stay home. If you follow the orders that we're giving you, then we'll allow you to do a certain amount of travel, the travel that we allow you to take. It is absolutely chilling and stunning, these words. And I encourage everyone, go back and replay what you've just heard. There's words at the bottom so you can see what he's saying. And he's saying the G20 agrees, the B20 agrees. This is what we're doing. They already have it prepared for rollout. So this isn't
We're going to get it mandated by the World Health Assembly.
Yes, that's right.
As part of these amendments to existing regulations. Yes. And Michelle, this brings me to the topic of the day, which is, what do we do about this? You've made the case, I think, very persuasively that this is, well, potentially disastrous for our country and for its people, our health, you know, freedom, as well as, you know, public policy more generally. There is, as I mentioned, something we've put together with your help. Mm-hmm. Very proud to have you as one of our leading lights, the Sovereignty Coalition. Mm-hmm. It's formed up just in the past month to try to fight for freedom from what the World Health Organization and the Biden administration, the Chinese communists and others have in mind for us. Talk a little bit about what we're doing in that regard and why it's vital that the American people, our audience most especially, become engaged.
Well, because this issue is essentially the existential threat to our freedom in our nation, we're asking people to call their two senators and their representative and demand that the United States gets out of the World Health Organization. That's the bottom line. We can't trust this organization, and it's a disgrace that it's the Biden administration that is the aggressor trying to put this forward to give up our sovereignty. So most of our senators and most of our congressmen have no idea this is even an issue. By design from the Biden administration, they again tried to fly under the radar on this. That's why we need the people to rise up and call their representatives and their senators and say, look, I don't consent to giving up the United States sovereignty to the United Nations. I want you to stop this. I demand that you get the United States out of the World Health Organization. Donald Trump did this when he was president, but the protocol says that there's a one-year time period for the United States to get out. Unfortunately, Donald Trump didn't return to office in 2020. So the first day Joe Biden came in as the new president, he restored the funding to the World Health Organization and notified them that the United States would go back in. So we have a real difference in how this is handled. Now, we the people can do something, and we need to contact our representatives immediately and tell them to get this process started, exit the World Health Organization.
There's good news on this front. Our sovereigntycoalition.org website has right on the front page an American sovereignty declaration. If it suits you, please sign it. And then go to the link. There's a Align Act option that will enable you to get directly in touch with the people Michelle Bachmann has just urged you to contact, your two senators and your representative in the U.S. House of Representatives, where, of course, she served with great distinction. And Michelle, the point of all of this is to say, as we're taping this show, we're talking on what we call Wexit, National Day of Action. We want people particularly now to get in touch with these representatives so that when they return from their districts, where they are at the moment, to Washington next week, they've been attuned to what their constituents want. Just talk a little bit about from your own personal experience.
Well, and this is actually
how important that
is. It is. This is very easy to do. It's really only one phone number. It's 202-224-3121. The Capitol operator will answer. You'll tell her where you live and that you want to be connected to your two U.S. senators and to your representative. And so you don't have to do a lot of research or digging, just that phone number, call that number. But then whoever answers the phone, tell them that you don't consent to what the Biden administration is doing and you want them to get the United States out of the World Health Organization immediately. And you want to know how the representative or senator will act. That's why it's important that you act now. This is moving very quickly. The Biden administration wanted to have this passed last year at the World Health Assembly. They didn't because some countries objected. The way this works in Geneva, Switzerland, is that amendments pass automatically unless there's objection. So last year, Botswana and a few African countries objected. That gave us a reprieve. We would have gone into this a year ago, but because there were objections, it didn't go through. The real protection that we have as Americans is not to hope for good action at the World Health Assembly. We need our government, our elected leaders, to hear our voices and our concerns and get the United States out of the World Health Organization, just like Donald Trump intended to do. We need to do that now because this is going to continue to plague us if we don't get out of that organization.
Well, it will begin to have the kind of dire effects that you're talking
immediately.
About. And in particular, this is because even if there are objections, say our government actually got up on its hind legs finally and said, no, we don't want to do this. A majority
vote
in the World Health Assembly can pass this stuff over our objections. Michelle, I wanted to have you address, because, of course, you have served in the United States Congress. Many of our listeners are probably under the illusion that the Senate won't ratify whatever these guys cook up, and therefore we'll be, you know, unimpaired. Speak to what's happened just within the past 2 weeks that indicates
that's
not so.
Thank you, Frank, for bringing this up, because this should get everyone's hair standing up on the back of their neck. Senator Ron Johnson of Wisconsin introduced an amendment last week that would call for any global pandemic treaty to come back into the U.S. Senate for a vote by the U.S. Senate. The Democrat-controlled Senate voted down that amendment.
Thank you, Michelle Bachmann. God bless you. Come back with...
Will do. Thanks, Frank.
Soon. We'll be right back with more right after this.
In cities across the country, black-garbed assailants clash with police in the streets, smash windows, and throw Molotov cocktails in an effort to destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa and provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
We're back, and we're back with one of the people that I've come to admire tremendously for his courage as well as his clarity about one of the most insidious political warfare instruments wielded by the radical left and their friends, among others, the Sharia supremacist community and, oh, I would say the Chinese Communist Party. Anybody who really hates America has allied and, generally speaking, made common cause with an organization called the Southern Poverty Law Center. Now, if you sense I have some feeling on this subject, it's because they have attacked me relentlessly. Make no bones about it, we have squared off in the court of public opinion for many years. But one of the things that I've admired about our first guest, one of the things I've admired about our next guest, Tyler O'Neill, is he's taken it to the Southern Poverty Law Center, or SPLC as it's called, notably in a terrific book entitled Making Hate Pay, The Corruption of the Southern Poverty Law Center. Tyler is these days the managing editor for the Daily Signal. He's widely published, and we wanted to catch up with him in particular about a piece that he had at the Daily Caller recently about the possibility that the SPLC might face the music, as he puts it. Tyler, welcome back. It's good to have you with us at Securing America.
Hey, glad to be here. Thanks, Frank.
So we'll get into the sort of particulars of this case that you've written about in a moment, but just set the predicate for us. You've obviously researched exhaustively this organization. Tell us about its beginnings and what it has become, not least very wealthy, and what they do with their enormous wealth.
Yeah. So the Southern Poverty Law Center, as the name suggests, was founded as a public interest legal organization to help poor people in the South. And in its early days, it got many people who were falsely convicted off of death row. It actually represented some reverse racism cases. It was a very, you know, it was laser focused on representing the people who needed representation. But by the 1980s, the founder Morris Dees started using the SPLC to go after the Ku Klux Klan and related organizations. Now, of course, everyone hates the KKK, and in the 1980s, the KKK was largely a paper tiger. So what would happen is the SPLC would file a lawsuit against the KKK, and it was like shooting fish in a barrel, according to the lawyers there at the SPLC. They would get these multi-million dollar judgments against these KKK groups that barely had $50,000 to their name. And so the group would be bankrupted. And in one particular case, a bereaved mother who had lost her son in a horrific lynching, the SPLC represented her, sued the KKK group. The SPLC got a multi-million dollar judgment, but the KKK group had 50 grand to their name. So the bereaved mother got 50 grand, and the SPLC got to say, oh, we got a multi-million dollar judgment. So the SPLC went to their donors and said, look at us, we're fighting hate, and got millions of dollars in donations. Whereas the bereaved mother got 50 grand. What did she do with that money? She went around and paid it back to the SPLC, who had given her a loan for a house for about 48 grand. So in other words, you know, the SPLC was the major beneficiary from this. And this is how the SPLC made its money. Morris Dees was a fundraiser par excellence, still is, direct mail fundraiser. And so the SPLC raked in all this cash. Many of the lawyers who started at the SPLC quit en masse because they said, we didn't sign up to fight the KKK. We signed up to help poor people in the South. Then fast forward, I mean, the SPLC ran out of grand dragons to conquer and started looking for more targets, and they ended up going with conservative organizations. And, you know, they've attacked the Center for Security Policy. They've attacked the Center for Immigration Studies. They've attacked Alliance Defending Freedom and the Family Research Council.
Yeah, and there was even America and on and on. Yeah,
yeah, exactly. But more and more mainstream conservatives ended up on this map with the Ku Klux Klan. And lo and behold, an LGBT activist decided to use that map to target the Family Research Council for a terrorist attack. And they've kept the FRC
Narrowly averted, was his intent to kill as many people there as he could. And as I recall, smash Chick-fil-A sandwiches in their faces as a gesture of his solidarity with the gay rights activist crowd. The thing about this is that it became a racket, didn't it? It was a money-making machine, yes, but it basically, the business model was defaming typically mainstream organizations that it simply didn't agree with politically. Ours was among them, and using that defamation to justify the argument that hate is abounding all over the country, and therefore more people need to give money to the SPLC. You mentioned Morris Dees as a prodigious fundraiser. I gather he is no longer working with the organization that he founded, thanks be to God. But tell us about how much money has been amassed by this so-called poverty organization.
Yeah. So the Southern Poverty Law Center has an endowment in excess of $500 million. That's half a billion dollars. And they have offshore accounts in the Cayman Islands.
Where they stash it.
It's a 501c3 nonprofit organization with Cayman Island accounts. Like,
Or it's a racketeering operation, which is really what I've always thought of it as. And this brings me to the present case. There is a fellow by the name of D.A. King. Tell us about him and the challenge that he's now facing, and a very promising opportunity perhaps as well.
Yeah, so D.A. King founded an organization called the Dustin Inman Society. He named it after a 16-year-old Georgia boy who was killed in a 2000 car crash caused by an illegal immigrant. The Dustin Inman Society is focused on combating illegal immigration. It even has legal immigrants on the board. So this is not about fighting immigration overall.
Or
this
xenophobia or racism or hating. Yeah.
Exactly. This is a policy group that's focused on actually applying the law. And so in 2011, interestingly, the person at the SPLC who was responsible for the hate group accusation and the part of the SPLC that oversees that actually told the Associated Press in 2011 that the Dustin Inman Society was not a hate group. And then 7 years later, they turned around and said, oh yeah, they're an anti-immigrant hate group. And to boot, most of the evidence they cited to attack the Dustin Inman Society as a hate group dates to before 2011. Imagine that.
So you have a group that they said wasn't a hate group doing exactly the same thing that it was doing when it was in that category. And subsequently, I gotta believe for reasons having to do with fundraising by the Southern Poverty Law Center, they become a hate group. And not for any evident reason. So there's a lawsuit trying to defend the Inman Society against the defamation by this slander-mongering, well, hate group. Let me call it what it is, the Southern Poverty Law Center. What's the latest in the court proceedings in that case?
Yeah, so it's interesting. The SPLC has faced multiple defamation lawsuits in the past, especially after the 2012 terror attack. A lot of conservative organizations wish to defend their good name after they've been slandered. But you know, while the SPLC goes to big tech, goes to the media, goes to the government and says, look, you need to silence, or you need to deplatform, or you need to go after these groups because they're hate groups. As soon as they're called out on this in court, they say, oh no, We're not stating facts. This is just our opinion protected by the First Amendment. And so it's interesting, in one of these briefs responding to the Dustin Inman Society, they say, oh, the Southern Poverty Law Center can't be expected to do in-depth research about the board of directors at the Dustin Inman Society. And they say this because the Dustin Inman Society in the lawsuit says, look, the SPLC is calling us an anti-immigrant hate group. We have three legal immigrants on our board, and this is something the SPLC must have known, because the SPLC, in its documents attacking us, notes that we have eight members of our board of directors. It's like, where would they get the information that there are eight members of the board? Maybe the website that says who the board members are, and where you can find that these board members are immigrants.
So, Tyler O'Neill, very quickly, there's been something of a breakthrough that is promising, I hope, for all of us, really, who have been slandered by these guys. Tell us what D.A. King has been able to accomplish so far and what may come of it.
Yeah, so this is a very big breakthrough. Oftentimes what happens is the SPLC says, we're protected by the First Amendment, and the courts don't give the conservative organization the time of day to defend their good name in court. And so what happens is the SPLC files a motion to dismiss, and the case just gets dismissed. But in this case, a judge denied the motion to dismiss, which means that the case, if it proceeds forward, will go to the process of discovery, in which case the Dustin Inman Society can go to the SPLC and demand documents.
Fabulous.
Regarding their hate group.
I understand that D.A. King and the Dustin Inman Society may need some resources to do this. How can people help in that regard quickly?
Yeah, so the Dustin Inman Society is raising funds on GoFundMe. It's gofundme.com/f/ please help us fight the SPLC. You can also find it by going to...
We're out of time. I gotta let it go with that. Tyler, come back with updates on all of this. This is very exciting, very important. Please help the Dustin Inman Society at GoFundMe. God bless you, my friend. We'll be right back with more right after this.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. What can I do? You probably have asked that question maybe daily as our country is being taken down by Biden administration officials hostile to this republic and routinely breaching their oaths of office to support and defend its constitution. Well, here's something consequential that every American can do today. If you don't want Team Biden to surrender our national sovereignty and your personal sovereignty to a totalitarian world government it is stealthily establishing, join us for the Wexit National Day of Action. Go to sovereigntycoalition.org and tell your elected representatives you want us to exit the World Health Organization now. Every congressional office in America should hear from at least one of their constituents, ideally, on this Wexit Day. Put your legislators on notice. They must ensure our public health policy will be determined by the USA, not the WHO. This is Frank Affney.
We're back, and it's a red-letter day whenever I can say we're back with Colonel Grant Newsom, United States Marine Corps retired, a man I've come to admire tremendously in the course of our collaborations on a number of things, including the Committee on the Present Danger, China, of which he is a very important member. He's also a senior fellow of our Center for Security Policy and the author of a terrific new book. It's entitled When China Attacks, a Warning to America. Colonel, it's good to have you back aboard. Welcome, sir.
Well, thanks very much. Glad to be here.
I wanted to start by getting your assessment of what we've seen in the days that have followed the meeting between House Speaker Kevin McCarthy and Taiwanese President Tsai Ing-wen in Southern California last week, that sheds light perhaps on the plan of attack, as you put it, that the Chinese Communist Party seems to be preparing for Taiwan and perhaps for others of us as well.
Sure. Well, it looks like they're putting together the systematic capabilities. We're systematically putting together the capabilities to be able to assault Taiwan and to think they could succeed. You have to look at this in a continuum of sorts and start back, a long time ago, but just for our purposes, last August, when they fired missiles all around Taiwan, moved some naval and air assets around. They bracketed Taiwan. They were showing that anytime they wanted, they could lock the place down. And that what you saw in this most recent exercise while President Tsai was in America meeting with Speaker McCarthy, they did a pretty large air naval exercise to get their act together and had their aircraft carrier out east of Taiwan as well. But they also declared an exercise to inspect shipping from Taiwan to the mainland and vice versa and other shipping in the Taiwan Strait. The next piece of the puzzle, I suspect next fall, will probably be an exercise of the landing operation. And so what they've done is they've put all the pieces together the way a sports team does at spring break, where the pitchers do their thing, the outfielders do theirs, the infielders practice, and then they come together. So I think they've gotten the military capability about where they want it and will be ready to go really after any time after next fall. I would expect they would wait until see the results of the election on Taiwan. Just a guess. But that is how they're going about things. It's very clear to see. And the question is, well, what are we going to do about it? The Chinese always telegraph their punches, and that's what they're doing now.
And that election will be the beginning of next year, as I recall, is it not?
That's
so
right. January
20th. They'll be ready to go this fall, but they will likely wait to see. On the hopes that the victor will be the KMT party that is rather more shall we say, aligned with the Chinese Communists, would you say?
That's right. Yeah. If the KMT candidate wins, I think the Chinese might pull back and expect the victor to bring Taiwan into the fold, however unwillingly. That's right. And you'd rather do that if you can, because it's just easier all around. If the other candidate wins from the DPP and they want nothing to do with Chinese enslavement, I think the gloves come off. But one situation you could find yourself in here is that the Chinese military capability has simply improved and improved and improved over the last 20 years. And it could reach a point where it's just so capable that the other side, both the Taiwanese and the Americans, could even say, well, it's just too much. We can't take it on. So there's actually a psychological aspect that comes of having a military capability. So this is going to get very difficult, I think.
Well, I'm so glad you mentioned this, because it's a kind of intangible aspect of the art of war, isn't it? It's the psychological domain and trying to persuade your adversary to give up without a fight gets you to the point that Sun Tzu recommended of winning without fighting, of course. And I guess the question to you, Grant Newsom, and you study these things very closely, and you do it from a forward deployed location in East Asia. I know from previous conversations with you that the Japanese, with whom you're very well acquainted, seemingly are under no illusion that they can allow this to go down, that conquest one way or the other of Taiwan without a fight. Could you see a situation in which the United States and maybe even the Taiwanese themselves are disposed to acquiesce, but others in the region would not? Or is it likely that the Chinese would roll the table up?
I don't think that Japan could handle it by themselves. I think what they would do is try to make the best of a mess and see if there's some way to salvage things so they and the Americans in particular can put up enough of a front that they'll be left alone for some period of time. I would expect Japan to go all out to develop nuclear weapons should Taiwan fall. But that isn't quite the ace in the hole that it seems, because you can have your bluff called. But I don't think that any individual country in Asia can handle China by themselves, not even the Japanese. They wouldn't like it, but I don't know that there's much they could do at this point. It's gotten too late in the day for that.
Yeah. This brings me to a topic that we're going to be discussing as we speak a little later in the day, a Committee on the Present Danger China webinar, which you will be a featured participant, where we'll be talking about the state of our alliances in the Pacific, specifically with your insights, but also in the Middle East, I hope in Latin America, and sort of more generally around the world, some of which has been put into, sort of sharp relief, shall we say, as a result of the leaks of some very sensitive documents, some of which apparently are authentic, some of which may not be, but nonetheless, the cumulative effect of it is clearly to engender new distrust and strains among America alliance partners. Talk a bit more about that with Colonel Grant Newsom, United States Marine Corps, and the author of When China Attacks, A Warning to America, on the other side of a very short break. And I want you to stay tuned, because you're going to need to know. Colonel Newsom, thanks. Stand by. Welcome back. We're visiting with Colonel Grant Newsom, United States Marine Corps retired, a man who has the distinction of not only served a senior rank in the United States military, but also having been a defense attaché in Japan, as well as a foreign service officer. In addition to all of that, he's been a senior executive in an international business in the Far East. And in short, he knows his way around the region. And Colonel, one of the things that we're going to be talking about in our webinar entitled Team Chaidan, No Worse Friend, No Better Enemy, a play on, I guess, General Mattis's famous comment about how the Marines are, no better friend and no worse enemy. When you look at these alliance relationships, and you indicated that the Japanese can't go it alone, none of the other nations in the region can against the Chinese, maybe even we can't go it alone, for that matter, almost certainly the case as the Biden, you know, takedown of our military progresses. But to the extent we do need alliances, give us a sense of the state of our relationships with the Japanese, yes, of course, the South Koreans, the Filipinos, maybe the Vietnamese, the Taiwanese, and the Indians, I guess, as well, the Australians. How does all that look to you? And more to the point, sir, your assessment of how it looks to the Chinese Communist Party.
Well, the good thing is probably that to the Chinese, it looks worse than it just might be. They would naturally assume that any sort of getting together between their opponents is done effectively, efficiently, and presents them with all sorts of problems. And in the real world, of course, things are never quite so smooth as they seem. One of the big problems is we're all getting at this so late in the day. Of course, for so many years, and really until about maybe 3 or 4 years, that there really wasn't any sort of widespread understanding, or belief is a better way to put it, of the Chinese threat. So it's all very late getting together. The Japanese, for example, get a lot of attention, and rightly so, because they potentially have a very powerful military that we absolutely must have if we're to prevail at a reasonable cost, ideally. But they, you know, we wasted too much time with them. I remember when we started trying to help them in serious earnestness around 10 years ago, that with an something we were doing specifically with the Japanese Army and Navy. As I remember thinking, you know, I wonder if we're 5 years too late getting started. You know, maybe not, but maybe. So it's late for the Japanese to finally figure out it's a dangerous neighborhood, they might have to do something. And America never insisted that they do what was necessary. So they're trying to catch up very fast. They have a long way to go. The Philippines is actually some good news because that the recent moves by the Americans and the Filipinos to actually strengthen a military alliance and make it into something that's useful. And the Filipinos have been very cooperative in opening up some bases to American.
This is very recent, is it?
Yeah, right?
We've seen some months. Very significant mm-hmm. exercises.
So that's a good sign. But in general, we don't have much time. I'd say that if you look at all of the allies, the friends we have, that we're really not able to do so much with them just yet. You know, there's good talk and some move towards allowing us to use some bases in use bases more in Australia. The submarine deal with the Australians, we're doing more with the Indians. It's moving in a good direction, but has it reached a point where it would really give us a big advantage in a fight against China, or even better, deter China? It's not there yet, but it's got a ways to go.
Talk to me a little bit about, if you would, the sorts of things that you're recommending in your book, When China Attacks, that we might yet still have time to adopt for the purposes of deterring the Chinese Communist Party from believing that it can act with impunity, or at least at an acceptable cost, against Taiwan in the first place and these other allies, including our own people and territory and assets as well.
Well, of course, there's the military angle to this, where we've got to get the U.S. military in a position where it is organized and has the hardware to be able to overwhelm China. If they attack, just make it so bloody that they won't dare do it. And you have got to have the manpower, the hardware, the specific weaponry to do that. You have to be able to operate it from the right locations. And so the military part of it, there's no way to get that capability on the cheap. You have to pay for it, and you have to make it a priority. And if you don't do that, well, you should not expect to prevail. But also there are alliances, our friends in the region. Who is it that will actually help us sort of increase our power to the point that we are able to take on China? And once again, make it clear to them beforehand that they better not do anything. So it's a question of capability, also will. Does that exist? But also go after China, not just in the military way, but make it clear that the financial results, the economic results of any move against China, against Taiwan, will result in just a complete cessation of trade and financial dealings with China. And it's free to do all the business it wants with North Korea and Russia, but it won't with the free world. And so China could head back to an agrarian society if it makes the wrong move. Make it clear that that's what's going to happen, but also attack the legitimacy of the Chinese communist regime. Remember what propaganda and political warfare is about. Xi Jinping has expressed his fear that we might actually do that. He told President Biden, don't attack the legitimacy of the Communist Party. Well, why not? Read the Chinese press for a day. Listen to what they say. They're constantly attacking democracy, Western values. And if we don't do this, well, we're tied one hand behind our back, and it's a big hand. So we've got to start doing some propaganda and political warfare.
Well, you've given me a perfect send-up for a pitch for my new book, which you've very helpfully blurbed. It's called The Indictment, and it is exactly that. It is an appeal. It is a recommended plan of action for taking on the legitimacy of the Chinese Communist Party, which is, after all, guilty of war crimes against us, yes, but also horrific crimes against its own people. We need to stand with those people and against our mutual enemy. Colonel Grant Newsom, thank you as always for your time and for your expertise and for your contribution to the upcoming webinar, which people can find out more about, get the video of it at presentdangerchina.org. Come back to us next time. Until then, this is Frank Affney. Go forth and multiply.